This morning we're going to begin our studies in the book of Judges. I intend to take the whole book of Judges this week. You might think that's rather rapid coverage. It's 21 chapters to take in 5 days. However, you will be glad we did, because it's the kind of book that if it gets stretched out too long, you get depressed for too prolonged a period of time. It's the most depressing book in the Bible, I would say. With the possible exception of some chapters in the books of Kings, Israel's history was not all that glamorous, even though they were called to be a chosen people and a godly nation and a holy priesthood unto God. Yet they very rarely continued in their piety for more than one generation at a time. And while they occasionally had great leaders who would reform them and bring them back to God and bring them back to a life of obedience to the law of God, most of the time, when they lacked these leaders, they were very quickly swept away into idolatry and into intermarriage with the Canaanite people, which brought a tremendous amount of compromise morally into the national life. And, of course, this usually resulted in judgment from God upon them. And their history was like this for hundreds of years. I mean, from practically the day Joshua died, they lapsed into idolatry. Perhaps it wasn't immediately after that. It might have been even a full generation later, but it didn't take very long. And so if you've read through the Old Testament before, you know that there's some very depressing chapters in the history of the people who were called to be a different holy people, who were supposed to shine the light of God's character to the rest of the world, but found very frequently that they did not do so at all, but rather that the character of the Canaanite heathen around them was rather imparted to them through contact, which should not have continued. You remember in the book of Joshua that they did not completely exterminate all of the Canaanites as God had commanded them to do. Let me turn your attention to something God had commanded in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7. Deuteronomy 7, verses 2 through 6, Moses warned the people before his death, "And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee," meaning the Canaanites, "thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them, neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth." So God commanded them to be different than other peoples, and he realized the only way to maintain this distinctiveness and this holy character of the nation was for them to obliterate all traces of the Canaanite religion. And that involved killing all the Canaanites. Now, a lot of people are a bit stumbled by the conquests of Joshua and the fact that God commanded the Jews to go in and slay women and children and beasts and everything, just to basically exterminate the whole peoples. And if that bothers us, we should remind ourselves that God has the right to bring judgment on any society in total if it has reached a point of irrecoverable evil. You see, we know of earlier cases where God wiped out whole societies. The Sodomites were wiped out by fire and brimstone, and certainly the women and children partook of that disaster, as well as the men of the city. In the days of Noah, even before that, we remember how God destroyed the whole population of the earth with a flood, and obviously women and children died in that disaster as well. And these are cases of God's punitive punishment upon people, and if he wished to bring judgment on the Canaanites as a complete society, he could have done so any way he wished. He could have done so through fire and brimstone, as he did with Sodom and Gomorrah, or through a flood, or any way he wanted to. It happens that since he had that land that was inhabited by the Canaanites, committed it to Israel because he had promised it to Abraham, that he chose to use the swords of the Jews to bring the needed judgment on the Canaanite people. And if you've studied it all, I don't know how much Jim may have gone into this when he went through Joshua with you, but the religion of the Canaanites was so abominable. They worshipped a god named Chemosh and another god named Molech, both of whom required infant sacrifices. The Canaanites regularly practiced temple prostitution, infant sacrifice, sacrificing live babies as a daily form of their worship, and many other abominations they did. Now, God tolerated this for many hundreds of years. In fact, even in the days of Abraham, several hundred years before Joshua's time, in Genesis chapter 15, God had told Abraham that he was eventually going to give this land to Abraham's offspring, but not before the Jews would spend 400 years in captivity in Egypt. And an interesting verse in Genesis 15, records this statement that God made to Abraham. Now, of course, this is before Abraham had a family, and therefore before there were any Jews, but this is a promise made looking into the distant future. And God said in Genesis 15:13, He said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. This is a reference to the 400 years they spent in Egypt until Moses led them out in the Exodus. That is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve, namely Egypt, will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go unto thy fathers in peace, that is, Abraham will die peacefully. Thou shalt be buried in your good old age. But in the fourth generation, and in this case it means after 400 years, they shall come hither again. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now what he's saying is, Abraham, you are now in Canaan, and this is the land that I'm going to give to your offspring. But first, your offspring are going to spend 400 years in a foreign land. But after that 400 years, I'm going to bring them back and they'll take this land again, this Canaan. And he said, the reason that's going to take 400 years, he said, is because the iniquity of the Amorites, or of the Canaanites, is not yet full. This is an amazing thing to me, because the iniquity of the Amorites was so foul in the days of Abraham even, that you would think that any God of justice would have to judge them sooner. But the mercy of God and His fact that the Bible says He's slow to wrath and plenteous in mercy is seen very clearly in the fact that He gave the Canaanites 400 years to repent of these abominable religious practices before He actually did bring judgment. However, judgment cannot wait forever. And the period of grace that God gave the Canaanites for 400 years did not influence them toward righteousness. And therefore the time came when judgment had to hit their society. And if it offends us that God had the Canaanites wiped out man, women, and child, remember, of course, that our sensibilities are not always as much based on rational thinking as on sentiment. For instance, the slaying of women seems barbarous to us, but realize that if the armies of Israel are being used as the agent of God's judgment, then all sinners are certainly worthy of judgment, and women can be as great sinners as men, certainly. And as far as the children are concerned, realize that those who had reached the age of accountability, that is, those who were old enough to know that they were sinners, were worthy of judgment too. Now, what that age is, no one knows. But those who had not reached the age of accountability upon being slain would, of course, be saved. As I understand the scriptures, little children who are not old enough to know the difference between good and evil, if they die, they go to be with the Lord. And so, really, those who were truly innocent were simply dispatched to a better place. I mean, better for those children to die young and go to be with the Lord than to live to maturity and become Moloch worshipers and then go to hell. So, really, there are some things where, if we think through the purposes of God and the ways of God, those things about Him that might offend us at first are shown to be not only just but very merciful. And so God told the Jews to exterminate all the Canaanites. And the purpose for this was that of all the nations of the earth, God wanted to have one that was different, one that was holy, one that kept His laws. And He knew that the practices of the Canaanites and of all other heathen peoples were alluring to the flesh. And that the Jews, though they had a high calling, did not have a high character. Their character was not particularly superior to that of any other ethnic group. And therefore, they could be allured into these sensual forms of worship. And so God said, to avoid that, just eliminate every trace of it so that you people don't be snared by these wicked practices. Well, we find in the book of Joshua that the Jews did succeed in taking the whole land of Canaan from the Canaanites, with the exception of some cities. There were some cities within the land, within the territory, that the Canaanites still possessed. For instance, Jerusalem was possessed by the Canaanite Jebusites until the days of David, which was quite a bit later in history. David was the one who finally drove the Jebusites out of Jerusalem and took that to be the capital of Judah. But we can see that it was partial obedience on the part of the generation that followed Joshua, and even less obedience on the part of the next generation that caused the problems that arose in the book of Judges. Now, the book of Judges does not have an author's name attached to it. According to Jewish tradition, it was written by Samuel. Now, there are some internal evidences in the book that would suggest that the time of Samuel is at least certainly the time of writing. Whether Samuel wrote it or not is not stated in the book. And the Jewish tradition need not be considered inspired. I mean, their traditions may be wrong. But it is certainly a conceivable theory that Samuel wrote this book. For one thing, it is written from a prophetic point of view, and Samuel is the first of the great prophets. Most of the books, including the historic books of the Old Testament, are written by prophets. And therefore, in them, we do not have the kind of history we would expect. You might have noticed in studying the history books of the Old Testament that the history is not told the way we would tell history. There are tremendous gaps where nothing is said about lengthy periods. And the heroes, we get very little biographical information about them. But rather what we have is a sketchy, selected history, selective of events that are considered to have value in showing us the dealings of God with His people. No doubt there were many periods of many years where God's special dealings were not seen in the history of Israel, and those periods are not mentioned because the prophets who wrote the history books were writing not just for the sake of preserving journals of the history of Israel, but rather to show the hand of God in Israel's history. And so we'll find that this is a selective history. There were certainly... Well, I mean, the period of the Judges was a lengthy period, and yet it's covered very briefly in only approximately 21 chapters. Now, internal evidence would suggest that Samuel, or at least the time of Samuel, is what we should look to for the writing of this book. For instance, we find four times in the book, from chapters 17 through 21, four times it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. It is certainly written as though the writer lived at a time where there was a king in Israel. If the writer lived before the kings of Israel, before the monarchy, then why would he say in those days there was no king in Israel? If, for instance, he didn't know that there ever would be a king in Israel, because it was not originally God's plan for there to be a king. Yet we know that in Samuel's time, the Jews came to Samuel and required that he make them a king. And so he did, after he consulted the Lord. But in chapter 17 and verse 6, it says, there was no king in Israel in those days, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. In chapter 18 and verse 1, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. And in chapter 19, verse 1 also says, and it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel. And then the very last verse in the book, as though stating a matter of great importance in our looking back upon the period, it says in chapter 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So four times we're told that at the time of the writing of this book, there was no, or at the time of the events of this book, there was no king in Israel. But the way it's worded sounds as though the writer lived at a period where there were kings in Israel. So that would have to be at least Samuel's time or later. Now, there are some other things that give us information about the time of writing. If you would look at Judges chapter 18, excuse me, and verse 31, without getting into the story that this is a part of, I'd just like to point out one point from this verse. Judges 18:31 says, "They set them up Micah's graven image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." Now this statement, "all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh," sounds like it's written after the house of God was no longer in Shiloh. Because if it was written while the house of God was still in Shiloh, meaning the tabernacle was still set up in this city called Shiloh, then how could the writer know whether all the time the house of God was in Shiloh that this image would be where it was? It would seem as though the writer is writing after the destruction of the house of God in Shiloh. That took place, if you have read further into the Old Testament than we've come in our studies, in 1 Samuel chapter 4. And there we read that the Philistines invaded Shiloh, took the Ark of the Covenant. Well, actually, they took the Ark of the Covenant first, then they invaded Shiloh, and they apparently destroyed the tabernacle at that time. And there are references to that both in the Psalms and in Jeremiah and in Ezekiel to the fact that the temple or the tabernacle in Shiloh had been destroyed. That was in the days of Samuel. In fact, apparently while Samuel was a young boy, that was the occasion when Eli died, who had raised Samuel. So the writer seems to be writing after that point, and even a little later, after the kings began to appoint it, that would be after the time of 1 Samuel chapter 8. But then there's another factor that we need to look at, and it's in Judges chapter 1 and verse 21. Judges 1:21 says, "And the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day." Now that means at the time the writer was writing this, the Jebusites still lived alongside the Benjamites in the city of Jerusalem. That's plainly stated. Well, we know for a fact from 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 6 through 8, that David, in his time, drove the Jebusites entirely out of Jerusalem and slew them and made Jerusalem the capital of the kingdom. And so this must have been written before David did that, because it was written while the Jebusites were still there. But in David's time, they were driven out. So the book was written after the time the monarchy was established, after the time that Shiloh was destroyed, but before David conquered Jerusalem. And that means it was written sometime during the reign of Saul or the early years of David, because there were two kings at the beginning, Saul first, and then, of course, David. Each reigned 40 years. And Samuel, of course, lived in the reigns of both those kings. So Samuel's time is generally the time that this was written, and the Jewish tradition that Samuel wrote it is a good one and is probably true. The book of Judges in the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew canon of Scripture, is the second in a group or a collection of books called the Former Prophets. Now, we in our Old Testament have what we call history book. We have the Pentateuch, which is the first five books. Then we have what we call history books, which start with Joshua and go through Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And then we have poetry books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Then we have the prophets. But the Jews, in their Bible, didn't call these historical books, they didn't call them historical books, they called them prophets. Joshua and Judges were the first two books in a collection called the Former Prophets. And then the books, which in our Bible we call them the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and the 12 minor prophets, those were called the latter prophets. So there were former prophets and later prophets. The books In our Bible that we call the prophets, they simply called the later prophets. The books in our Bible that we call history, from Joshua through Esther, they called those the former prophets because they were, well, even though they weren't written with the name of a prophet attached to them, they are considered to have been written by prophets, and certainly the prophets appear in all of them. So that is why the Jews categorize this book. The word judges refers to the leaders in the book who are raised up by God as deliverers. They were mainly military deliverers. We think of judges as someone who sits at a bench in a courtroom and arbitrates in legal disputes. And it may be that there was some of that that the judges did. We are told, for instance, that Deborah did that, but she did that as a prophetess, the Bible says. The Bible says that she was a prophetess, and she sat under a particular tree, and people came to her for decisions to be made about legal disputes they had. Whether the other judges did that kind of arbitration or not, we aren't told, but we can assume they probably did. And the main thing that we see that the judges did was rally the armies of Israel to throw off oppression at various periods of time. And during the years that the judges were alive, it would seem the people remained true to God. But then when the judges would die, the people would backslide again very quickly. This book takes place after the death of Joshua, as you can see from verse 1 of the first chapter, now after the death of Joshua. And it describes the period of Israel that lasted probably about 300 years. There are years that are mentioned in the book that if you calculate them, if you calculate the years that are spent under the oppression of foreigners and the years that are spent under the leadership of the judges, the total number of years would appear to be 410 years for the period. But that cannot be the number of years for the period because in 1 Kings 6:1 makes a statement that we should take into consideration and determine how long the judges reigned in Israel. It says, "And it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziph, that he built the house of the Lord." This is talking about what year Solomon built the temple. It was the fourth year of Solomon's reign. But it is said to be the 480th year since the children of Israel escaped from Egypt. Now, consider the number 480 as the total period from the Exodus till the building of the temple. What shorter periods are included in that? Well, there's 40 years of wandering in the wilderness before the days of the conquest. So you've got to subtract that from the 480. So it brings it down to 440. There were about 25 years of the life of Joshua during the conquest and following. So subtract that from your 440, you've got 415. Now, then you have the period of the judges, and at the end of the period of judges, you have 40 years reign of Saul. So subtract that and you get down to, I'm not very good at math, what's it bring us to? About 375. Then you subtract 40 years of David's reign, brings it down to 335. Then you subtract the first 4 years of Solomon's reign, which brings it down to 330. And then there's an unknown period of years that include the life of Eli and Samuel before Saul is made king. Now, these are all the periods that are within the 480 years. And it brings the total number of the period of the judges, what's left for the period of judges, is down around the 300 mark. And traditionally, the period of the judges was 300 years. Near the end of the period, we have a statement from Jephthah, who was one of the late judges. And we should maybe have a look at what he said here. In Judges 11:26. He's speaking. It says, "While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns, and Aroer and her towns and all the cities that were along by the coast of Arnon 300 years. Why, therefore, did you not recover them within that time? Now, this 300 years that he makes reference to, we didn't pick up the context of it, but he's referring to the period of Judges at that time as being 300 years. And he lived near the end of that period. He might have been rounding it off. It might have been a little less than 300, a little more. But again, traditionally, the period is 300 years. Now, what do we do with the fact that if you total up the years of oppression and the years of the Judges, that you get a total of 410 years? Now, on the sheet that I gave you, I handed out a sheet. It shows you the a list of the various oppressions and the judges. It might be hard to read the chart there, but you see where it says oppressions and duration, judges and duration across there and the dotted line under that line. We can see that the duration of each oppression, the first was 8 years, the next was 18, then we have 20 years and 7 and 18 and 40. The years of oppression that Israel endured were 111 altogether. Whereas if you total up the duration of each of the judges' reign or leadership, it totals 299. If you add those together, you get 410 years. Now, how do you get 410 years and squeeze that down into 300? Is there a contradiction to the Scripture? No, there's not, because we are not reading in Judges a consecutive history where one of these things necessarily followed immediately after another. What we have is there were various oppressions in different parts of the country at the same time. Some of these periods overlap. You will find that some of the judges, or each of the judges, ruled over only a little part of Israel and delivered that part of Israel from some oppression, from the Philistines or the Moabites or whatever. There is no one of the judges that ruled over the whole country. They didn't have a king in those days. And judges were local deliverers that rose up to deliver the people from local oppressions. So that an oppression by the Mesopotamians might have been taking place alongside or at the same time as the oppressions of Moab, or the oppression under Midian could have been taking place at the same time as the oppression under the Ammonites or whatever. So that there could have been more than one of these oppressions taking place at the same time, because it's very certain that they must have overlapped. And that would, of course, account for what would seem to be a discrepancy. It isn't a discrepancy, because some of those years overlap each other. For instance, it's possible that Shamgar, we don't have any number of years for his judgeship, but let's say Ehud, his judgeship of 80 years could have included the 40 years of Deborah and Barak, conceivably, because it was in a different part of the country. So this is how we figure. Now, you might not care very much about this kind of detail, but the fact is, if you're interested in mastering Israel's history, it's good to know, you know, how long they were under the judges, because it's a very significant part of their history. It is almost as long a period as the time they had kings. And therefore, it is not a small matter, although it is certainly given less attention and less detail in the Bible is given to it than the period of the kings. We have to realize we're dealing with a period that's longer than the history of the United States of America so far. So it's a long period of time we're dealing with here, about 300 years probably. Now, it's very clear that since there was no king, and we saw that four times in the book of Judges, it says in those days there was no king in Israel, that there was no central government, there was no strong leader. Now, when the Jews escaped from Egypt, they had a very strong leader, Moses. And every time someone rose up against him, God came to Moses' rescue and did something like send a plague on the people who were rebelling, or open the earth to swallow them or something. And Moses was definitely the God-ordained leader of a period of 40 years wandering in the wilderness. After him, Joshua was clearly the successor of Moses, because Moses laid hands on Joshua and said, "This man is going to be my successor." And God said to Joshua in chapter 1 of that book, "As I was with Moses, so shall I be with you." And so the people followed Joshua as a strong leader, just as they followed Moses. In fact, apparently a little better than they followed Moses. But when Joshua died, he left no successor. And so 65 years in the early days of Israel's history after the Exodus, they had strong leaders, but now they had none. Now, what are they supposed to do? What they did have was possessions in the land, which Joshua had administrated, that they divide up among themselves. And each tribe became a separate and independent unit. And the only thing that joined all the tribes together in any sense was the fact that they had a common religion. At least some of the time they did. They were supposed to. And they had a form of government which was supposed to be a theocracy. Now, a theocracy is a government by God. That is, God being the only ruler. Theocracy means that God is the ruler. And that was what Israel's government was supposed to be. And that's why they didn't have a king. Neither Moses nor Joshua were kings. And none of the judges were kings. In fact, one of them, Gideon, was offered kingship. When he delivered the people from the Midianites, the people said, "Be our king." He says, "I won't be a king. You shall not have a king because God is your king." And that was understood. During the days of the judges, no human king was permissible. And later on, at the end of that period, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, which records the end of the period of the judges, the people came to Samuel, who was the last of the judges, and said to him, "Give us a king to rule us like the other nations have." And the thing displeased Samuel, and he went to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Give them their request, and don't feel too bad. It's not you they're rejecting, but they're rejecting me that I should not rule over them." So God's the one who felt rejection in that situation because they sought a king when he wanted to be their king and they needed no earthly king because they had God as their king. So the period of judges was supposed to be what we call a theocracy. By the way, with reference to them requiring a king, the book of Hosea speaks of this. Much later in history, the prophet Hosea looks back at the time when the Jews required a king and when God gave them Saul, whose name significantly means asked for, in Hosea chapter 13 and verses 9 through 11. Hosea 13, verses 9 through 11. God said through the prophet, "O Israel, you have destroyed yourself, but in me is your help. I will be your king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities, and thy judges from whom thou saidest, 'Give me a king and princes'? I gave thee a king in mine anger, and I took him away in my wrath," said the prophet. So Hosea, this is many centuries later, in Hosea 13, verses 9 through 11, said that God had given them the king they requested, but he gave them a king in anger. He was not pleased when they asked for a king. The period of the judges was, in a sense, it could have been the ideal form of government under God. However, because of the nature of man, it did not turn out to be ideal. We see twice there was no king in Israel and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Well, if everybody was doing what they thought was right, if everyone, you know, had a right concept of what was right, then things would have been better than they turned out in the period of the judges. But their character was so bad and their values were so corrupted that even though everyone did what they thought of as right, they were many times doing things that were really wrong in the eyes of God. They apparently were not consulting the Word of God to know what was right and wrong. And they were consulting their own human nature. And because human nature is so corrupt, a situation like the judges, where everyone's able to do whatever seems right in his own eyes, under God, of course, didn't seem to work out. They didn't remain faithful to God. And that is why, of course, eventually the Messiah was to be sent, who was to be their king. And Jesus is that king and that Messiah. And now that Jesus has come, we have the kingdom established in its ideal state. I mean, it wasn't ideal under the earthly kings, and it wasn't ideal under the judges, but we have sort of the best of both. We have the perfect king, who is God, Jesus. So we have not thrown off the rulership of God, as the Jews did, but we have, in fact, a king that is God incarnate. And we do not have a situation where every man does what's right in his own eyes. Rather, as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. And those who are in this kingdom are those who are being led by the Spirit of God and not by what their own ideas of what right and wrong are. So the Jews lacked that during the period of the judges, and they lacked something else during the period of the kings. But when Jesus came, he fulfilled all the requirements for the ideal situation that they needed. That we need, and which we now have. Let's see. Look at this sheet that I've given you. At the top of the sheet, it says, it gives sort of an outline of the repetitious cycle that we find in the book of Judges. If you haven't read the book of Judges, you may not be able to appreciate this until you do. But what we do find is an almost redundant repetition of the same old mistakes. And what we find is that at first there's a godly generation, like those who lived in the days of Joshua. But after that generation dies off, their children are spiritually indifferent. And then the next generation, or even at the end of that second generation, there is open apostasy where they begin to adopt other religious practices that are forbidden by God. And of course, that brings the inevitable result of God's punishment. In the book of Judges, the punishment always was in the form of an enemy nation, whom the Jews should have driven out completely, but they failed to do. Those nations were given strength against their Jewish neighbors by God to be made an oppressor to the Jews as a punishment for their apostasy. Then, after a period of oppression, and some of them were as short as 7 years, others were as long as 40 years in duration. But after some period of oppression, the people would realize that they'd made a big mistake and they needed to turn back to God. They'd repent, and God would raise up a deliverer to deliver them, and there'd be a period of peace. That takes us to the beginning of the cycle again, point number one, a godly generation. But then when that generation died off, you'd have a spiritually indifferent generation, then apostasy again, and it goes around and around and around. There are seven complete cycles like this in the book of Judges. Seven complete cycles. Now, even though there's only seven cycles, yet there are 14 people who are prominent in the book as judges, if we include Abimelech. Now, Abimelech was Gideon's son. And he was not rightly a judge. He was not raised up by God. He is a prominent person in the history because he made himself a leader. The other judges were raised up by God. And by the way, unlike kings, the judges' leadership was not hereditary. They didn't start dynasties like kings do. So that when a judge died, it was not assumed that his son would become the next judge. Although, in the days of Samuel, the people, when they wanted a king, said, "Samuel, you are old and your sons are corrupt, so give us a king." And they were implying that Samuel's sons would be natural successors to the judgeship. And yet, during the book of Judges, we don't see this being the case. The judges are not related to each other. They don't start dynasties. They don't pass their leadership on to a son when they die. As long as they're alive, things go well. When they die, the nation is left without a leader again, or at least that part of the nation where they ruled. So they don't have hereditary dynasties. However, when Gideon died, who was for 40 years the judge of Israel, his son Abimelech killed all of Gideon's other sons, except for one who escaped, and made himself ruler. Now, he was Gideon's son by a concubine, and so he got the relatives of this concubine on his side, and they staged a revolt and slew all the sons of Gideon except him, and for 3 years he maintained a usurpation of the position. He called himself a king, yet this is not a rightful kingship because God never approved him, and eventually he was killed by a very humiliating accident, a woman dropping a millstone on his head from the top of a wall. And he didn't want to go down in history remembered as the man who was killed by a woman, so he insisted that one of his soldiers kill him to put him out of his misery. So that was the end of this man. But since he was not rightly a judge, he's not really part of one of these cycles. But he is in the 14 judges or 14 persons who are prominent leaders in the book. There are 12 administrations because there are 13 judges, but only 12 administrations because Deborah and Barak, who were both judges, ruled at the same time. And you can see that the reason we say there's only seven cycles is because some of the judges came to power without any reference to the cycle. They just, after Gideon, for instance, Abimelech, and then there's mention of a guy named Tola and another named Jair, and of course before that was Shamgar. And there's no particular reference to a period of oppression in those cases, or with Isban, Elon, or Abdon. These are judges whose we don't know very much about, except they rose up for a period of time and in some way rule the people. I put down at the bottom of this sheet that there are six, or I guess seven, judges that we could call major judges. They are the ones who are known to have been involved in one of these cycles: Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Barak, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. The others, six, would have to be called minor judges, about whom we know almost nothing except maybe a verse about each one. Okay, let's see if we can finish up this introduction pretty quick. You might be interested on your own in looking up other parts of the Scripture that make reference to some of the events and people in the book of Judges. It's, of course, helps to confirm and establish the historicity of the book that later prophets and writers speak of the things that happen in this book. I'll give you a list of references if you want to. We won't take the time right now to look them all up, but if you're interested, you can look them up later. I would recommend that you write them down, because if you think at the moment you're not going to look them up, you might change your mind later. 1 Samuel 12, verses 9 through 11. That's 1 Samuel 12, verses 9 through 11. Then 2 Samuel 11:21. 2 Samuel 11:21. Then two of the Psalms, Psalm 78, verses 61 through 64. That is Psalm 78, 61 through 64. And Psalm 83, verse 11. 83:11. Then there's a couple of places in Isaiah. Isaiah 9:4. And Isaiah 10:24. In the New Testament, we have two references. One is in Paul's sermon at Pisidian Antioch in Acts 13:20. Acts chapter 13, verse 20. And, of course, very familiarly, in Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, Hebrews 11:32 makes reference to Gideon and Barak and Jephthah as men of faith. Hebrews 11:32. So these are the places in the rest of the Bible where we find references coming back to us. There are some other characters who lived during the period of Judges, but who are not mentioned in the book of Judges. For instance, the book of Ruth, which immediately follows the book of Judges in our Bible. The book of Ruth took place during the period of the Judges, as you can tell by reading the first verse of the book of Ruth. Ruth 1:1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled." And so Ruth and Naomi, Boaz, these characters who figure prominently in the lineage of David, they lived during the period of the judges. Ruth was David's great-grandmother. Also living at that period of time, at the end of that time, were Eli and Samuel. And we read of their story in the first seven chapters of 1 Samuel. So this is the entire period of the judges, kind of summarized. Eli and Samuel. I might mention that the term "the angel of the Lord," which appears many times in the Old Testament, about 80 times in the Old Testament, appears about 20 times in the book of Judges. Now, the book of Judges is a very small book compared to the rest of the Old Testament, but it has a disproportionately large number of references to the angel of the Lord. 80 references in the Old Testament, 20 in the book of Judges. And the reason that may be significant is that many scholars are in agreement that references to the angel of the Lord, as opposed to an angel of the Lord, are references to a theophany or an appearance of Christ prior to his incarnation. This might seem strange if you've never heard of theophany, you who are new students here or guests, but theophanies are simply times when Jesus seems to have appeared on earth for a brief moment to deliver a message or to do something like wrestle with Jacob or walk with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, or appear to Moses in the burning bush, or lead the children of Israel in a cloud, or do those kinds of things, or give water in the wilderness from the stone, which is Christ. There are references to divine visitations in the Old Testament. They are usually called theophanies or sometimes Christophanies, which simply means appearances of God or appearances of Christ. And many scholars are of the opinion that when you find the term the angel of the Lord, as opposed to an angel of the Lord, that these are references to theophanies. And that means that God himself is appearing to deliver a message. Now, if that is true, then it's interesting that although the period of Judges was rightly called the Dark Ages of Israel's history, and a very depressing period to read about, yet God was nonetheless actively involved in their history, visiting, usually to rebuke, but sometimes to commission a deliverer. So a lot of sin in the book, but also a lot of intervention from God. The book would divide naturally into three parts, though no one can agree where the first part ends. It either ends at the end of chapter... Well, let me tell you. The first part is simply a summary of the history of the period. And it takes up about two chapters, and different persons would divide it at a different point, and you can make your own decision where you think it ought to be divided. Some would divide it, of course, the first chapter is included, and then some would include only six verses of chapter 2, or five verses. Include all of chapter 2 and the first four verses of chapter 3. So I don't know where you want to divide it. All of this is basic summary information. See, the second section, which we might as well say starts at chapter 3, verse 5, begins to give us the history of these seven cycles of the judges. Prior to that, it only summarizes the cycle and some of the events that happened before that. So the first segment is a summary of the period. Let's just for the sake of nailing it down, say it's the first two chapters and the first four verses of chapter 3. After that commences the history of the particular judges, and that goes on through chapter 16, ending up with Samson, the last of the judges. And then there are five chapters remaining. This is where I gave a faulty assignment last night. I said read the last four chapters. I should have said the last five chapters. Chapters 17 through 21 could rightly be called an appendix, or perhaps more properly, two appendices, because there are two stories at the end which are not in their chronological place. They probably belong to an early part of the period. They are added as addendums after you've given something like a chronological history of the seven cycles of judgeship. Then there are two stories which are included in those last five chapters, both of them extremely depressing. The last one is the most depressing of all, so that you kind of come away from the book when you finish it with this horrible feeling in your stomach. I guess that's the idea, because then the last verse says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And you just come away feeling, man, if that's what happens when everyone does what's right in his own eyes, I don't want it. I want to do what Jesus wants and not what's right in my eyes. So that is perhaps as much introduction as we need to give to the book, maybe a little more than some of you would have wanted. Let's get into the book itself. How are we doing? Okay, we got some time still. Good. Okay, we'll start at chapter 1. Now, before I do start at chapter 1, I might say that the most logical beginning of the book is really at chapter 2. And I say that because, again, the book isn't written entirely in a chronological order. It is arranged just for the sake of its demonstrating what God was doing in the nation Israel. And it seems very obvious that chapter 2, verses 6 through 10 would make a very logical opening to the book. If you look at chapter 2, verses 6 through 10 for a moment, you'll see what I mean. It says, "And when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man to his inheritance to possess the land." That sounds like we're just coming out of the book of Joshua for the first time here. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. Now notice, that falls earlier than chapter 1, verse 1. Because chapter 1, verse 1 says, now after the death of Joshua. So in the first chapter, we take up things that happened after Joshua died. But here in chapter 2, we actually are going back during the lifetime of Joshua and say, now, when Joshua finished the conquest, he let the people go, they went to their possession, and during his lifetime, they served the Lord. And also, during the lifetime of his generation, that is, or maybe his children's generation, those who outlived him, but who had seen the great works of the Lord. That would mean perhaps any of the people who had lived during the wandering in the wilderness and seen God's guidance there, and particularly those who had lived during the conquest and seen things like the fall of Jericho and other miraculous intervention from God. Now, those who had seen those things served God faithfully, but, after verse 8, in verse 9 it says, they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the Mount of Ephraim on the north side of the hill of Gaash. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers. That means they all died and were buried. And there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Now, that is really bad, that there was a nation that could have, a generation that could have come up not knowing the works of the Lord, because God had commanded that generation under Moses to teach those things to their children and to their children's children and to their children's children's children, and that there should never come a time when any generation would arise who was unfamiliar with what God had done. You remember when God instituted the Passover way back in Exodus chapter 12 and 13. He said, you shall commemorate it each year in this way. You know, get all the leaven out of your houses and, you know, eat the lamb and so forth and all the things that we're supposed to do. And he said, now when your children ask you, why are we doing this? What is the meaning of this? He says, you shall tell them, we do this because with a mighty hand God delivered us from the hand of Pharaoh when we were slaves in Egypt. In other words, there were ceremonies that were built into their annual religious life which were supposed to raise questions among their children, which would give opportunity to explain and rehearse the things that God had done for the people, so that their children each year would be hearing again about it. And every 7 years, according to Deuteronomy, every 7 years, everyone in Israel is supposed to gather together and hear the whole law of God read out loud on the Feast of Tabernacles, I guess it was supposed to be, or I think it was at the Feast of Tabernacles. They were supposed to read the law out loud every seventh year. And so that would mean that every 7 years, everyone would become aware of the law. And if a person lived to be 70 years old, he would have heard it 10 times. Of course, he couldn't run down to his local Bible bookstore and buy a leather-bound version. And most people wouldn't have a copy of their own, but at least every 7 years, they'd hear it again. And by the time you reach a ripe old age, you would have heard it enough times to have some general familiarity with it. By the time you're 21 years old, you'd have heard it 3 times at least. And so, this was supposed to be happening. And they set up stones and pillars and altars, Ebenezers. Whenever they came into the land and whenever they made a great conquest, they set up a memorial of it. And this was supposed to be to remind their children and to give the children an opportunity to say, what's that doing there? And their fathers were supposed to say, this is set up to remember what God, the mighty things God did for us. And so that a generation would arise who didn't know the works of the Lord is of course an implication upon the generation that is said to have served the Lord. They served the Lord, but they didn't transmit to their children what they should have transmitted to them. Now, it is one of the great frustrations, I guess we could say, of church history, that whenever God brought revival, or whenever a great movement began, we see the same pattern that we see in the book of Judges. Whenever there's a great revival under someone like Wesley or Finney or Moody or Evan Roberts or any of these guys, there's a generation that experiences that revival and is deeply touched by that revival and are very zealous for God during their lifetime. But almost certainly, the next generation is somewhat indifferent And I don't know why it is. I'm sure there's always some cases where someone transmits to their children the spiritual zeal that they have. But in general, the second generation in any movement is usually a lot more lukewarm than their parents were. And it's a scary thing to think about because, you think, well, if this revival could just continue for a few generations, the whole world would be touched by it. When you read about the Welsh revival or the revivals under Charles Finney, and you find out, every town he went to, the whole town was converted or something. Just think of this man or his descendants or, if he had children and grandchildren, if he could, they just could have kept going, what would have happened? The kingdom would have come and the will of God would be done on earth as it is in heaven. But for some reason, these things usually die in the second or at least the third generation. And you can look at movements like the Salvation Army and the Methodist Church and those which started with tremendous revivals under anointed spirit-filled leaders and see that in so many cases, they've become dead and liberal, and it's for some of them, it's past the third generation. But this is the pattern we see here. This should be instructive to us, those of us who have children or whoever will, that we have got to take great pains not only to promote the movement that we find ourselves involved in, but to transmit it to our children. And I feel that one of the great flaws of Christian leaders of almost all movements that I've ever seen has been that they get so caught up in the move of God in their day and reaching their generation and trying to change the world in that generation that many times their kids get left behind. And a lot of times their kids are left at home while daddy goes out and preaches all over the world and, and he's bringing great revival, but the kids are not receiving that. In fact, they almost resent it in some cases because it's this thing that takes their father out of the home and brings insecurity into their lives and things. And I think that it's very often the case that, in fact, I don't know of very many cases where the next generation is brought up. One thing, the Salvation Army, General Booth, his daughter, our daughters and children were involved in his movement, and his movement lasted a little longer for that reason before it was corrupted because his children were out there preaching on the streets with him. And I think that that's a wise thing. And somehow we need to transmit to our children the vision for the kingdom of God that we have. And then also the vision for them to train their children. And the Jews were told to do that with their children, but they didn't. And so a generation arose that didn't know about the works of the Lord. And that's where all the trouble started. Okay. Now, I read that section in chapter 2 because that seems like a logical beginning to the book, but we'll go back now to the apparent beginning at chapter 1 and verse 1. And this tells us things that happened after Joshua died, but before the godly generation died off. See, we just kind of read in chapter 2, verses 6 through 10, about after Joshua and his generation died off, then things went bad. But now, in chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2, what we're going to read about is before that generation died off, but after Joshua did. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them?" Well, you remember that during Joshua's lifetime, they had conquered the lands of the Canaanites, but there were some cities that still needed to be subdued at the death of Joshua. And so they sensed that, especially now with their strong leader dead, they needed to make it their business to try to get rid of the enemy so that, the enemy couldn't take advantage of their leaderless society and make a comeback. So they sought the Lord, and probably that meant through the priests and the Urim and the Thummim, to find out who should go first. The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand." And Judah said unto Simeon, his brother, notice this, Judah and Simeon, his brother, as though we're talking about the man Judah and the man Simeon, because Judah and Simeon, the historical characters, were brothers. Yet we're talking about not the individuals, because they were long dead. We're talking about their tribes, the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Simeon. And we need to recognize that the writer speaks in that way. He speaks of a tribe as though it were an individual person. That's just a manner of speaking that would be foreign to our way of speaking, but we're going to find it throughout the narrative. Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I likewise will go with thee into thy lot." So Simeon went with him. So they had a mutual agreement. You help me beat my enemies, and then when we've got them licked, I'll come over and help you beat yours. Easier than both of us trying to work individually. And Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they slew of them in Bezek 10,000 men. And they found Adoni-Bezek in Bezek, who was the king of the Canaanites there, and they fought against him, and they slew the Canaanites and the Perizzites. But Adoni-Bezek fled, and they pursued after him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. This was in accordance with the custom of that time, which is very obvious by what the next verse tells us. Adoni-Bezek had done the exact same thing to 70 other kings that he had conquered. Apparently this was customary, that rather than killing the king, you'd have more sport with them after you beat them by humiliating them and making them incapable of holding a sword by cutting their thumbs off, and incapable of flight or running by cutting their big toes off so they could hardly balance. And so these guys would be reduced to a life of begging, and it was generally so that they begged under the table of the conquering king. That is, these guys who had formerly been kings in their own right were now mutilated so that all they could do to survive was to just grovel on the floor under the table of the king who had conquered them and hope for crumbs to fall off. This was, of course, a way of having more sport at the expense of the kings that they conquered rather than just killing them. Well, Adoni-Bezek had himself done this to 70 kings that he had conquered, and now it happens to him. Interestingly, Adoni-Bezek said 70 kings, that's 70, with their having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their meat under my table. As I have done, so God hath acquitted me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. He didn't necessarily die immediately, but he lived there the rest of his life, however long or short that may have been, and died there. Now, I think it's interesting that it is mentioned that this king saw the poetic justice of the situation. Rather than just being angry and bitter, it seems as though he had a soft enough heart to realize that he was being judged an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, literally. Stroke for stroke, you know, thumb for thumb, toe for toe. And he said, God has requited me, or God has paid me back for the evils I've done. He didn't say Jehovah. The word God is Elohim, which is a generic term for God. Whatever God he worshipped was the God he was thinking of, rather than Jehovah. But he still saw that there was a divine justice in what had happened to him. That's something better than a lot of Christians see when they have trials come on them as the result of their sins, when they end up reaping what they've sown, rather than saying, well, I guess it's what I deserve. Very often they'll find reasons to be bitter and even angry at God for it. This man was more noble than they. It's already depressing, isn't it? You don't have to get very far into it to start getting depressed. Verse 8 says, now the children of Judah had fought against Jerusalem and had taken it and smitten it with the edge of the sword and set it on fire. Now from that it looks like Jerusalem came totally under the power of the children of Judah. But later in verse 21, it says, and the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. Now, in case that sounds like there's a contradiction, where it says that in one place, verse 8, it says that the people of Judah drove out the Jebusites and put them to the sword and set the city on fire. But in verse 21, it says the Benjamites failed to do so and the Jebusites are still there to this day. We have to realize that the city of Jerusalem was divided into two parts. And in later times, including during the period of the monarchy, it was half Benjamite territory and half Judah's territory. The city of Jerusalem was divided, and half of it belonged to Judah and half to Benjamin. Apparently, what we're seeing here is that the children of Judah had success in conquering their half of the city, but the Benjamites didn't have equal success, and so it was in the days of David that he came and drove out, finally, all the Jebusites, which the Benjamites had failed to drive out. Verse 9 says, and afterward, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites that dwelt in the mountain and in the south and in the valley. And Judah went against the Canaanites that dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba. And they slew Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. And from thence he went against the inhabitants, he is Judah, the tribe of Judah, went against the inhabitants of Debir, and the name of Debir before was Kirjath Sefer. In other words, they renamed all these towns. They all had Canaanite names before and they gave them Hebrew names afterward. Verses 12 through 15 tells a story that you've already encountered in Joshua. In Joshua 15, verses 16 through 19, this set of verses appears almost verbatim, or it might even be verbatim, the same. But it's mentioned here because it's in connection with what Judah was doing, and Caleb was of that tribe, or was had his lot among Judah. It says, Caleb said, "He that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer, and taketh it, to him will I give Aksah, my daughter, to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. And he gave him Aksah, his daughter, to wife. And it came to pass, when she came to him, that she moved him to ask her father a field. And she lighted from her ass, and Caleb said to her, 'What do you want?' And she said unto him, 'Give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a south land, give me also springs of water.'" Apparently the south land, the Negev, was kind of dry during that period of time. Although earlier in Jewish history, during the days of Lot, it had been a very fertile garden, but this was after God destroyed the cities of that plain with fire and brimstone in the days of Lot, when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, and that period, that place down there was pretty dry, as it is now. If you go to the southern region of Israel, the Negev is quite arid desert. And so she says, "You gave me some south land, and, you know, it doesn't have any water in it, so could you give me some springs of water? Give me some property that has some water, too." So Caleb gave her some upper springs, and nether springs simply means lower springs in the valleys. So this story is identical to the way it's told in Joshua 15, verses 16 through 19. And perhaps the only comment I should make is it describes Othniel in verse 13 as the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. And just from what I've heard and read from people commenting on this, there seems to be some disagreement as to whether Othniel is Caleb's younger brother or his nephew. And the question, of course, hinges on whether Kenaz is Caleb's younger brother or whether Othniel is. You can see how it's worded could be taken either way. Othniel was the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. Who is Caleb's younger brother, Othniel or Kenaz? The fact is, Kenaz is. We know that because Caleb's father was someone named Jephunneh. And if Othniel was his younger brother, then his father's name would be Jephunneh also, because he couldn't be his brother without having the same father in Israel. And so Caleb and Kenaz were the sons of Jephunneh, and Othniel was the nephew of Caleb. And he also figures later on in chapter 3 as the first of the judges. That's not brought up here. We were introduced to him in Joshua, first of all, but then later he comes up in the book of Judges as the first to be a deliverer from the Mesopotamians and to judge Israel for a period of 40 years. Verse 16, "And the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth in the south of Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people." Now, this is significant. Now, I need to make two comments about it. First of all, it says the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. Well, why is it that it speaks of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, when Moses' father-in-law was a Midianite? You remember from the book of Exodus that Moses, when he fled from Pharaoh at age 40, he met some women who were being pestered by some young shepherds at a well, and he helped them, and they took him home with them, and he married one of them, and their father's name was Jethro, also called Reuel or Raguel, depending on which portion of the Bible you're reading about him in. Jethro or Raguel or Reuel. Now, he was the priest of Midian, and apparently a Midianite. Here, there's a reference to Moses' father-in-law as a Kenite. Now, some might think, well, maybe Moses had more than one wife, and this Kenite was the father-in-law of, you know, through the other wife. But I think the problem is solved by comparing a couple other scriptures. If you look at Numbers chapter 10, Numbers chapter 10 and verse 29. "Moses said unto Hobab, the son of Raguel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are journeying unto the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. And he asked him to come along." And this Hobab, who was the son of Moses' father-in-law, son of Raguel, that's another name for Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. So this was Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, okay? And basically, Moses pressed the guy into service as a guide through the wilderness, since that guy knew the place and Moses didn't. So it is said that Hobab was the son of Raguel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. Now look at Judges chapter 4 and verse 11. Judges 4:11 says, "Now Heber the Kenite," there's that word Kenite that appears in chapter 1, as Moses' father-in-law. "Now Heber the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses." Now look at that. Hobab is spoken of as the father-in-law of Moses. And yet we know from Numbers that Hobab was the brother-in-law of Moses, the son of Raguel, Moses' father-in-law. So we see that Hobab here, for some reason, is called the father-in-law of Moses. Now, the reason is not clear. One thing that could be suggested is there could have been a scribal error in the transmission of the document. Some people don't like that kind of suggestion, but the fact is, it is well known that as the ancient Old Testament documents were transmitted, that there were occasional slight insignificant scribal errors. We know this by simply comparing the different manuscripts that exist from the period, and they differ on a few little points, which means that if they were all copied from the same original, someone made a little slip of the pen or made a mistake. And it is possible that some scribe substituted the word father-in-law for brother-in-law. We don't need to see it that way, however. It could be simply saying that Hobab was related to Moses through Moses' father-in-law, but the wording is not as we would word it. But then when we get back to chapter 1, verse 16, we see the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. Well, the Kenite was Hobab, as we saw in chapter 4, verse 11. Hobab was a Kenite. And the word Kenite simply means a smith, like a metalsmith, like a blacksmith or a coppersmith or something. And that's what the word Kenite means. So what we would probably be led to conclude from this is that Moses' father-in-law was a Midianite priest, but had a son named Hobab, who was a smith. And apparently Hobab's children also carried on the family trade of smithing, and so forth. They were called Kenites, or smiths. That's how names get started. We have a lot of smiths in our English language, too. Probably their name goes back to a similar origin as that. But the point here is that for whatever reasons, Hobab is called Moses' father-in-law, probably simply, it could be, as I said, a slip of the scribe's pen somewhere in copying the manuscripts that were used here, or else it could simply be saying that this man was related through the father-in-law of Moses, to Moses. We can't really say what the reason is, but these are the Kenites that are mentioned. And the reason they're mentioned here in chapter 1 and verse 16 is because of how they figure in the story of Deborah. Because the Kenites, we're told here in chapter 1, verse 16, separated themselves from the children of Judah after they'd helped guide Moses and the people through the land, and they found places of their own to live in. And in chapter 4, we see that again. It says now, Heber, in verse 11, the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent under the plain of, whatchamacallit. So, the Kenites, first of all, separated themselves from Judah. And then this one family, Heber, separated himself from the Kenites. And the reason this is being mentioned is because when Sisera, the general who was fighting against Deborah and Barak, fled, he fled into the house of Heber, the Kenite. And because the Kenite had been separated from the Jews, it was thought that the man would be safe there when he was fleeing from the Jews. He thought that maybe the Kenites would not be favorable to the Jews, but he turned out to be deathly wrong. That's where he found himself nailed by the wife of Heber, nailed to the floor, to be exact, through the head. Now, back to chapter 1. It's depressing. verse 17. "And Judah went with Simeon, his brother, and they slew the Canaanites that inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. And the name of that city was formerly called Hormah. Also, Judah took Gaza, which was a Philistine city, as are Ascalon and Ekron that are mentioned there. So now we turn to the Philistine territories that were being conquered. And it says, interestingly, in verse 19, the Lord was with Judah, and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, meaning the Philistine inhabitants, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. Now, two things at least need to be said about this verse. One is that it sounds like God couldn't drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. The way it reads, it says, the Lord was with Judah, and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. Now, just the way we would read that might sound like it's saying the Lord drove out the people of the mountain, but the Lord couldn't drive out the people of the valley. But realize that the he could refer back to Judah and almost certainly must. Judah, because the Lord was with him, Judah was able to drive out the inhabitants of the mountain, but he, Judah, was not able to drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. Well, you might think that this is still saying that the Lord being with him, he should have been able to conquer them unless the Lord has trouble with chariots of iron. And it's impossible to imagine that God would have any problem wiping out chariots of iron. In fact, we know that he has no problem with such things because in chapter 4 and verse 15, we find that Sisera, chapter 4 and verse 15, Sisera had 900 chariots of iron. It doesn't say that in that verse. We're told that earlier. But in verse 15 it says, the Lord discomfited Sisera and all his chariots. So even though Sisera had 900 chariots of iron, as we're told elsewhere, let me see, where do we see that? Verse 13, okay. Sisera gathered together his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron. So Sisera had 900 chariots of iron, but God overthrew him anyway. No problem to the Lord. So why were the people of Judah unable to wipe out the people of the valley who had chariots of iron if the Lord was with them? Well, the Lord was with them when they fought against the people of the mountain and gave them victory. But apparently, the chariots of iron intimidated the Jews so much that they didn't have faith to conquer the people with the chariots of iron, and God was not with them to the same in the same strength and the same anointing and power because of their lack of faith. Remember that lack of faith can limit God. It says in the Psalms that the children of Israel, when they saw the giants in Canaan and brought back an evil report and didn't believe that God could give them the victory over the giants, they limited the Holy One of Israel, the Bible says. They limited God by their lack of faith. And it says in one place that Jesus, when he went to his hometown in Nazareth, which was, since it was his hometown, the people were very familiar with him and they didn't believe he was the Son of God, it says he could do no mighty works there because of their lack of faith. So because of the lack of faith, God and Jesus himself were limited in what they could do for their people. And it's very clear that there needs to be faith in God before God's power can be released. And so the Jews, apparently, when they saw these chariots of iron, their faith failed them and their courage failed them. And so they were unable to drive out those chariots of iron, even though God was more than able to handle those chariots of iron, because we see he did so later on in chapter 4 when he overthrew Sisera, 900 chariots of that type. The mention of the chariots of iron calls to mind an interesting thing, because it suggests that the Philistines had iron, but the Jews didn't. And that is in agreement with what archaeologists have found of this period. During this period of the Judges, which is roughly from 1400 B.C. to 1100 B.C., I didn't tell you that before, but you might want that information. The period of the Judges is roughly from 1400 to 1100 B.C. And during the latter part of this period, archaeologists have found in the ruins of the Philistine civilization, the use of iron was very pronounced. They used iron quite a bit. This was the early Iron Age. This is the beginning of what is called the Iron Age. And the Philistines got iron before anyone else did in that area. There is no iron found in the ruins of Jewish civilization of that period. So it confirms, archaeology again confirms what the Bible says. And because the Philistines controlled the iron industry, it was easy for them to keep the Jews in subjection later. Later on, for instance, you remember a guy named, or maybe you don't remember if you haven't read it yet, but a guy named Shamgar. It says in chapter 3 and verse 31, after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who slew of the Philistines 600 men with an ox goad. And he was also delivered Israel. Now, an ox goad is just a sharp stick for poking the rear ends of oxen when they're not cooperating to make them move along. But the reason he slew all these Philistines with an ox goad is because he didn't have anything else. The Philistines didn't let the Jews have metal. The Philistines controlled the metal industry. And later on, we remember that Samson slew 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. Again, lacking regular weapons, he just took whatever was at hand and slew of the Philistines. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 13, this is just before, a little bit before David slew Goliath, a few chapters early of it, but this is a time when the Philistines were oppressing Israel later in David's days and Saul's, and it says in verse 19, "Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords and spears. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his farming tools, share, coulter, and axe, and his mattock. Yet they had a file for the mattocks, and they had for the coulters, which is a part of a plow, and for the forks, and for the axes to sharpen the goads, the cattle goads. So it came to pass in that day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan. But with Saul and Jonathan, his son, there were some found." So they managed somehow to get a couple swords and spears for the king and his son at least to carry, but no one else had them. Because the Philistines didn't let the Jews have metal or metalsmiths whenever the Philistines were oppressing them. And if the Jews had some metal tools for farming, but if they wanted to sharpen them, they had to go down to the Philistines and get them sharpened because the Philistines wouldn't let them have any trained smiths, lest they should start turning their plowshares into swords and their pruning hooks into spears. Okay, back to Judges chapter 1, verse 20. "And they gave Hebron unto Caleb, and Moses said, as Moses said, and he expelled from there the three sons of Anak." The Anakim were giants, the sons of Anak. "And the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites." We already saw that. They did not do that, so the Jebusites stayed in Jerusalem until the time of David. Then we have the house of Joseph mentioned as they conquered Bethel. It says in verse 22, "The house of Joseph, they also went up against Bethel. The Lord was with them, and the house of Joseph sent to descry," or to spy out is a more modern word for that, to descry, to spy out Bethel. Now, the name of that city before was Luz. We're told that many times in the book of Genesis as well, that that was the name of the city before. "And the spies saw a man come forth out of the city, and they said to him, show us, I pray thee, the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy. And when he showed them the entrance to the city, they smote the city with the edge of the sword. They let go the man and all his family. The man went into the land of the Hittites and built a city and called the name of it Luz, which is the name of it to this day." Now, here's a guy who is a turncoat on his own fellow citizens. Perhaps he had little choice. They would have killed him. He was no hero. So when he was threatened with his life to show them the entrance of the city, he quickly turned on his own countrymen and showed the children of Ephraim and Manasseh, that'd be the children of Joseph, he'd show them how to get into the city. So they did, and they spared him, just like Rahab the harlot was spared when Jericho fell. So this man and his family were spared, and it says he later migrated to the land of the Hittites, and he built a city of his own, probably a very small community of his own clan, but he named it Luz, which of course was the original name of his own hometown. So he wanted to perpetuate the name of the city that he was instrumental in overthrowing by naming this new community, which he founded as by the old name Luz. Okay, we don't need to read all the verses that follow in this chapter because it simply goes through a list of cities that were not defeated by the different tribes. In verse 27 says, "Neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of," then it gives a number of towns. Verse 29 says, "Neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites that dwelt in Gezer, but the Canaanites dwell in Gezer among them." So Manasseh and Ephraim are, of course, the two parts of the house of Joseph, which is mentioned in verse 22, the house of Joseph. They did conquer Bethel, but they didn't conquer these other cities that are named. Verse 30 says, "Neither did Zebulun drive out." Another tribe failed. Verse 31, "Neither did Asher drive out." Verse 33, neither did Naphtali drive out. And when we get to verse 34, and the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, and they would not suffer them to come down into the valley. But the Amorites would dwell in the Mount Heres and Aijalon and Shalbim and in Shalbim. Yet the hand of the house of Joseph prevailed, so that they became tributaries. And the coast of the Amorites was from the going up of Akrabim, which means the place of the scorpions, from the rock and upward. Now, this simply gives an account of six of the 12 tribes and their failure to do all that they should have done. And in chapter 2, which we don't have time to get into this morning, we will tomorrow. In chapter 2, we find an angel from the Lord came from Gilgal to rebuke them for not completely wiping the people out. Well, we have the impression that they tried but failed to wipe the people out. So why should they be rebuked for that? Obviously, because the only reason they could possibly fail is because they didn't trust God. Because God had promised them the complete victory. And if they failed to get the complete victory, the blame must be laid at their own door for their failure to obey completely and to trust God completely for that final victory. Well, a very depressing introduction to a very depressing book. And I don't want you to get too depressed. That's why we're going to cover the whole book in a week. And we will have a bit of relief when we study the book of Ruth, which is, though it is set in the same period, it is nonetheless very, very different in character than this book, in that it's very beautiful, a beautiful story telling something about the lineage of David. For tomorrow, read the last five chapters of this book, please. And we'll just plan to cover those. You might also read through, you know, chapters 2 and 3, because we'll have to do something with those tomorrow also. So, if that's not too confusing, read the last five chapters and chapters 2 and 3 as well, because we're going to take the last five chapters, which are the most depressing of all the book, and get those out of the way early so we can sort of try to recover by the end of the week, recover our emotions. Okay? Let's just break then for about, what do you take, 15 minutes? I forget. YWAM's on a different schedule, so I give them... Read the last five chapters of this book, please. And we'll just plan to cover those. You might also read through, you know, chapters 2 and 3, because we'll have to do something with those tomorrow also. So, if that's not too confusing, read the last five chapters and chapters 2 and 3 as well, because we're going to take the last five chapters, which are the most depressing of all the book, and get those out of the way early so we can sort of try to recover by the end of the week, recover our emotions. Okay, let's just break then for...